This is Joy Paris, and you're listening to the Empathy Global Podcast. Here we will come together and listen to the stories and struggles of people around the world. No blame, no political bent. We share our stories to erase the lines that are separating our increasingly fractured world. Because in the end, if nothing else, we are all profoundly human. And finding the beauty in that and being willing to feel someone else's pain, someone else's story with them, that is empathy.
Are you looking for a way that you can support us here at Empathy Global? If so, you can visit us at patreon.com/empathyglobal. You can support us for as little as $2 a month. And while that doesn't seem like a lot, it means everything to us. Right now, we're trying to cover hosting costs, domain costs, synchronization costs, and things like that, as well as trying to plan another tour up the West Coast. So anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Also, if you visit us at empathyglobal.org, we have a store where you can purchase shirts. So if you're interested in one of those, please come check us out. We want to let you know that we have a book club going on. It's on Facebook only, so you don't have to live in Florida, and the more people, the better the discussions are. So if you're interested in joining that, just go to empathyglobal.org and click on the book club link. Thank you all for your support. Hi everyone, thank you for tuning in. Today we're talking about the stigmas behind mental illness. So I've got three guests here. Who wants to start introducing themselves first?
I guess we will go clockwise. Hey, right. I'm Randolph.
Hi, Randolph. Full disclosure, this is my husband, so. Okay,
fair enough. Yeah, right. Now you know who I am.
Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Randolph. I am 23 years old. I am a music director as well as a teacher. And I struggle with bipolar disorder.
Okay. Want to go ahead, Brandy?
Hi, my name is Brandy. I'm a high school English teacher. I am 42 years old, and I struggle with depression and OCD.
Okay. Hi, I'm Tate. I'm 21 years old, and I'm a person that struggles with borderline personality disorder.
Okay. So... Randolph, you want to go first and just sort of tell us your story, maybe when you first figured out that you...
I feel like I should have jotted down notes so I can get all of this straight here.
Yeah, okay.
But, so I found out a while ago, I don't know exactly how old I was, but I found out that bipolar disorder actually ran in my family. So I, growing up, you know, I noticed the traits in my dad, I knew it in my grandfather. And when I was probably about 13 or 14, my brother actually ended up getting diagnosed with depression as well. And, you know, I thought that I was lucky. It had skipped me because I'm like, if I hadn't found it up to this point when they got him so young, that, you know, I was okay. And that was not the case. I will say what I think probably happened for me was, you know, I got it genetically, but it was... a lot of circumstantial happenings acted as like a catalyst for it. So I was probably about 16 or 17, just a lot of different stresses in school and home. And, you know, I think a lack of a healthy social life and dynamics with that probably didn't help. It really began to rear its head when I was... I'm trying to think, I was about 17 when I really noticed it was weighing on me. And when I was 21, I had attempted suicide. And thank God, you know, obviously it didn't work. You know, I feel like I didn't tell anyone because anyone that knew me, I feel like they wouldn't believe me. And so to kind of let you guys in on it, if you guys have heard the show Million Little Things, we watched that last night, the first show. I tried everything I could not to cry. I'm going to have to watch that show by myself and not in front of people. But the dynamic of the show is you have these group of friends, and basically the one happiest one, the one that was taking care of everyone else, who seemed to have nothing wrong with him, he's the one that killed himself. And everyone else was questioning why, you know. It's like, that's our friend. How do we not notice? How do we not show any signs? And I don't know what direction the show is going to take, but I feel like that's kind of how, like, I was. Like, I was always... the funny guy and the one that, you know, took on everyone else's burdens, and that probably didn't help me a lot because it wasn't healthy because I didn't find a way to deal with it, especially for myself. It wasn't until, you know, after I had attempted suicide, I'm like, you know what, this is a sign to me that it didn't work and I need to get help. This is the next step. So I went, got an official diagnosis. I was on medicine for a mood stabilizer as well as antidepressants. I was on that for probably about maybe a year. I ended up weaning myself off of it. And I can talk a little bit more about that later, because that just, it kind of sucked away all of my personality, or so I felt. Mm-hmm. So, but that is the Cliff Notes version of my story, like the trailer of my life. So pass the baton.
Pass the baton. Mm-hmm. Pass the
sharing stick. The talking stick. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't really know what age I first started having OCD tendencies. It's just something that I've always remembered. My earliest memory of feeling that something was wrong was before 1983, because that's when my brother was born. So I was younger than seven, and it would just be silly things. And talking aloud about it, it does sound silly, but I would be walking, and I would have to walk a certain way. I couldn't, like, step on a crack. And if I accidentally stepped on a crack, I would have to walk back and redo it. And when you're 7 years old, you just panic because your mom's walking ahead of you and she doesn't know why you're dawdling. She just thinks you're like not keeping up. But in your mind, you're like, oh my God, I have to go back and rewalk. And that's my earliest memory of having this weird feeling that I didn't notice, or behavior that I didn't notice anybody else having. Mm. And just getting really, really good at hiding it. Hiding my little idiosyncrasies, being in like second grade and the teacher calling you up to line up, all the kids to line up. And if I couldn't get my pencil at a certain angle, I wouldn't go line up. But I knew that, you know, I was disobeying. So I knew I had to go and line up, but there was no way I could not leave my pencil at a right angle. So I would pretend to like trip. Or I would pretend to accidentally, you know, bump into the desk. Yeah. So I would have to go back and do it. So to hide the fact that, you know, I was crazy in my mind. Yeah. And this is, you know, I can't, being a mother now, I can't imagine the burden of that on, you know, a little 9 or 10 year old. But those were my earliest memories. It transpired more into touching car doors, having certain like rhythms, you had to touch certain things. And like I said, I was just like a master of hiding it. Just really sneaky. Oh, I think I forgot to blow out the candle, so let me go and, you know, but what I was really doing was, you know, touching the door 5 times. Mm. I don't know what else to say. That's just, it's always been present in my life. It's always been there. I didn't realize what it was until after I had my first son and I had postpartum depression. Mm. So I was actually in counseling for the first time. And this was when I was 22. And I was able to open up and, you know, describe these things. And then I was, you know, I knew what it was, and I was put on Prozac for the depression. But it didn't really, the OCD never abated, like, to this day. Mm-hmm. It has decreased. Having children has made it decrease, definitely. But it's still there every day of my life.
How does that affect you being a teacher? Do you think being a teacher, like, goes along with it because you can be really organized and stuff? Or do
no.
you think it's frustrating?
And that is the biggest thing I wanted to talk about, is that people confuse people with OCD to organization and neurotic tidiness and like the Sheldons of the world. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the case at all. Like, I'm not super organized or tidy. Mm. But I still have these things.
Yeah, so it's more random things and less like specific
like ticks,
cleanliness
almost.
Things.
Yeah, no, yeah, no, you can look at, I mean, I've got a dusty house, I've got, you know, that's
but
the thing.
Things don't set off your...
No, yeah, things so. Don't have to be in order. It could be something really stupid and random, like...
So your pencil had to be in order, but
right.
only because
that was just the one thing. That didn't have to be like, yeah, it, like I can't explain it, but
right.
That's the biggest thing that annoys me. Like when people are like, oh, I'm really OCD about this. Well, like, that's not what it means. Like, it's just,
no.
not.
People use the word OCD like...
as an adjective.
Like you're a neatneck or a... Yeah, like, oh, like I'm really like particular. Like I like to do this. Yeah. But it's just...
It's not the same.
It's not. Mm-hmm. No, not at all.
All right, Tate, you want to take over?
Well, I guess my story starts pretty much when I was born because it's a personality disorder. And I don't really know. I used to slam doors a lot when I was a kid, and I didn't know why. You know, it's a kid thing to do, but, you know, I still sometimes do it now. So, and it kind of makes me feel stupid when I do it because I'm like, wow, I'm acting like a child. But, like, I don't know. Things that I think will help sometimes don't. Should I give a background on borderline?
Sure.
Yeah. Borderline personality disorder is where there's your amygdala, the emotional regulation center of your brain, is overreactive. So I pretty much overreact to situations all the time, the way that normal people would see it. In my mind, the way that I'm reacting is completely normal because I feel the emotions that I'm feeling so strongly. And it makes day-to-day very difficult because a certain thing could set me off and somebody will look at me like I'm crazy because I saw a cute dog on the street and started crying because the dog was so cute. Like, you know, something really stupid. And people look at me like I'm really dumb a lot of the time, and I've lost a lot of friends because of it, because I'll overreact to a situation and then they don't want to be my friend anymore because I'm crazy. Mm-hmm. And it's made life difficult. I can give a short, quick example. When I was in high school, I was in a boarding school, and I had to do a project with this kid, and he didn't do anything for the project, and he had one single job, which was to get a board, and we were supposed to make a board game. And I planned everything out. All he had to do was get the board. And he didn't get the board, and it was the night before it was due. And so I'm taping pieces of paper together, and he has a bunch of people come up and start drawing on this board while I'm trying to do the project. And I went to my room, and I was just crying, and I was so angry because in my head I thought, I'm gonna fail this, and that's gonna fail me from the class, and then I'm gonna fail high school, and I'm never gonna do anything with my life. And it sounds like an overreaction, like saying it now. But I literally felt like I was gonna die from this having people start drawing on the board. I got so overwhelmed, and this girl came into my room to find my roommate, and she's just like, "What's wrong?" And I was like, Sean messed up our project, and now I think I'm gonna fail it because it's messed up and I can't fix it. And she's like, "Well, why are you in your room crying about it when you can go fix it?" And this is one of my most vivid memories to today, because I'll be sitting there in one of my emotional states and be like, you know, why am I sitting here crying when I can get up and fix it? And then it makes me cry more because I can't just get up and fix it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So tell me about your process of sort of figuring out that you have borderline.
I was diagnosed with so many different things from so many different doctors, and they told me that I had PTSD, anxiety, bipolar, pretty much like almost everything you can think of. For a short time, they told me I had mild schizophrenia, which, you know, obviously made me freak out because I'm like, wait, what? Yeah. I don't want. And so they just gave me all these crazy diagnoses, and I decided to look it up.
Those things?
Yeah, I have been on every single ADHD medication, and none of them worked for me. I've taken most antidepressants, none of them worked for me. I was on lithium for a while, which was awful for me. I started hallucinating.
Wow.
And yeah, what was I talking about?
How you got diagnosed.
Oh, so I had to diagnose myself, which I'm the type of person that I'm not going to like look at something and be like, oh, I have this because I have three of the whatever symptoms. I really looked hard into it because I was tired of all of the diagnoses, and I came up with borderline, and I went to my therapist and said, hey, I think I have borderline. She's like, hey, I think you're right. Let's do a brain scan. And they did a brain scan, and it showed that my amygdala was, you know, reacting more. Hmm. Which the whole brain scan is I have to sit in a room, like, completely relaxed and stare at a wall for, like, 20 minutes. Which is very hard because you can't, like, you can't move. You can't really do anything because your brain will react to it. And it was a very difficult process. I had to do it a couple times.
But didn't it feel good to know that you had, like, physical proof? Like, evidence? Like, I'm not... this is a physical thing in my body, medically. And I'm not... It's not just all in my head. It's bad.
It definitely helped. You know what I mean? Well, I mean, it is in my head. It's mental illness.
Right.
Anytime somebody's like, oh, that's in your head, I'm like, yeah, it's mental illness.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it did feel good to be able to be like, hey, I don't just cry at seeing dogs. Like, there's actually something that triggers in my brain to be like, hey, you're going to cry over that dog now. Mm. So.
Yeah. And it might help you to sort of regulate, like, so you know what might happen if, you know, because you know why that's happening.
It also helped with understanding why, like, the medications weren't working for me. It's because I didn't have, like, depression. I didn't have
the right stuff.
Bipolar. So the bipolar medications didn't work for me because it was borderline. With borderline, you don't have any medication that's going to, like, not that medication fixes anything, but there's no medication that you can take for borderline that's going to, you know, work. Like,
change
some of them might help with symptoms, but...
Yeah. Interesting. So I just sort of wanted to talk about the stigmas and culture behind mental illness, because we have this huge umbrella of mental illness where we just call everything, you know, anything that's physiological but is part of your brain, we just say, oh, that's mental illness. And, you know, especially lately with the school shootings and people say, oh, we don't have, it's not a gun problem, it's a mental illness problem. And so then it's like, well, what does that say about mental illness? Like, does that basically stigmatizes every person with mental illness that they're like a potential school shooter. Mm-hmm. And not to say that there aren't some mental illnesses that make people more potentially a danger to society or things that we need to look out for and things like that. I'm not saying that we like discount that. But that's why I thought it was important to sit down here and say, okay, these are three people that are regular participating members of society, right, who struggled with a mental illness their whole life. And some, you know, Brandy, you were saying, like, for years, no one even knew that there was anything wrong. You know, Randall,
right.
For years, you were able to hide it. You were even able to hide a suicide attempt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there are so many things that, you know, you are, I hate using the word normal, right? But you seem to be a normal person. You seem to not have any mental issues, but they're really still there. And the problem with using the word normal and not normal is that there is no normal. There's no, like, typical person that this is, like, this is the way we all want to be, and
it's a matter of perspective.
These are the things wrong with me that are not wrong with this typical normal person,
right?
Everybody has something, and some people it's, like, physical illness, some people it's trauma, some people it's a mental illness, some people, you know, physical, like, abnormalities, you know, like, everybody has something that they struggle with, you know, and this just happens to be our struggle, you know. I myself deal with depression. I never chose to do any type of medication or anything for it, and mine seemed to be related to a few different things that I was able to sort of cope with, so I got lucky in that way. But it does frustrate me when I see, like, the types of things people say about people with mental illness. So I wanted to talk about, does anybody want to weigh in on that before we kind of move on?
Well, what I do, I mean, it should just be treated as an illness, just Like, just even the stigma of taking an antidepressant. Mm-hmm. Like, you wouldn't bat an eye if someone had to use insulin or something, heart medication.
Right.
But if it's an antidepressant, you know, I would be embarrassed. I would literally be embarrassed if any of my colleagues at work knew I was taking antidepressants. And that's, I shouldn't feel that way because I'm sure there are a lot of people there that take medications for other physical ailments. Mm-hmm. But it's just, yeah, it is a shame that it's stigmatized like that.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting when you were telling your story that you said even at 7 years old that you felt you should hide it.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Like, where do you think that comes from?
That was more because I didn't want to get in trouble. I didn't want it to seem like I... Because I was, you know, I was a good kid. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it to seem like I was disobeying.
Right.
So, yeah. I'm not blatantly disobeying you. I'm just...
Right.
Yeah.
So you didn't feel like telling your mom... I'm not dawdling, I need to step on the cracks, would have made any sense to her.
I tried to tell her once. I don't remember how old I was, what I even said. I remember she was watching Dallas, which is a very 80s show, so to put it in, you know, a time frame. I do. I remember clearly she was watching Dallas, and I waited for a commercial because, you know, back then we couldn't pause. And
I wouldn't know.
No DVRs?
No. No, back then you couldn't pause and, you know, you had to time yourself. So you had, like, you know, maybe 2 minutes to talk to mom or dad.
Right.
And I tried telling her and she was just like, well, that's just silly, you know? Mm. You know, then just put your pencil somewhere else. Or just, she just, and it wasn't because she, you know, didn't love me or wasn't, didn't, you know, have empathy. She just, she didn't understand. She just thought I was being silly.
Wasn't the kind of awareness of mental illness that there is now.
Right, yeah. And I also couldn't verbalize, like, this feeling I was getting if I didn't, you know, take care of these compulsions, in which I now know is the onset of a panic attack, an anxiety mm-hmm. attack, which at 7 just felt like something was about to explode inside my body, and everybody I loved was going to die. Like, to best describe it, that's exactly how I felt. And so there was just a non-issue, like, that pencil was getting back there because to get rid of this feeling in my body, I had to put the pencil back.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Anyone else want to weigh in on that, the cultural?
I mean, my thoughts about this are something that I haven't really discussed with anyone, but, you know, this is the platform for it. I think a lot of that comes from, at least in the American culture, we're going to take it to this level. The glorification of self. For example, if there's something wrong with you, well, then you're not good enough, you're not great. So everyone's going to hide up any defect. That's why we take medicines for any other physical ailments. But if we admit there's something wrong in our head, I mean, there's nothing really to cover that up, because that's like the end of the line. There's nothing else. But
it is true that with American culture, we're individualistic to sort of an epidemic, that you know, more collectivist cultures, they take care of you no matter what if you're their family, you know? But here in America, it's like your successes are your own and your failures are your own. So you're sort of responsible. And it doesn't mean that no one cares about you. They do. But even like in marriages and families, we still sort of consider ourselves as an individual that is part of the family and not necessarily as a unit. And so we tend to be a lot more... ashamed when we feel like we have a problem, because it's not the family's problem, it's mine. And in a lot of other
especially
cultures,
when we don't know how to fix it,
right,
we're just sitting there and we're stuck with it.
And I think that may be part of the stigma of mental illness, is that there isn't like a fix. Like, if you have a heart problem, it's like you get a transplant and things could be better, right? But maybe if it's something that you have to live with,
there's not a surgery or transplant or anything.
There's not.
For it.
Even if you can find a medication that works, it may not work all of the time.
It's not guaranteed, yeah.
Right. And even then, it's like I'm taking a medication, and if I don't take it, I am still a person with this disorder, right? And so it could be that you feel that it's like more permanent or something. But I also think it's because of the way people don't know about mental illness, the things that they do hear sound terrible. Like, Tate, you had something to say about that with, like, media and stuff like that.
Oh, like the TV shows.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez, yeah.
I recently have been seeing a lot more TV shows with characters that have that have borderline personality disorder.
Emphasis on the air quotes that just were thrown up. Yeah.
There's this new show that came out called Insatiable. And mm-hmm. it has this girl who's obviously clinically has something wrong with her. It's about how she used to be fat and now she's skinny and she wants to take revenge against everyone. And I'm not going to spoil it, even though I...
We aren't sponsored by the show, so you're okay. Insatiable on Netflix now.
Yeah, it is a Netflix original, so you're right. But at some point in the show, she says something about how she wants... This priest came to her and said she needs to have an exorcism, and she starts to get convinced that she has a demon inside of her. And at some point, the person that she's talking to is like, oh, well, it could all just be symptoms of borderline personality disorder. And as I was watching this, like, I literally paused it and walked out of the room because I was so upset that they, like, released this stigma. Like, this girl ends up, like, killing people. Mm-hmm. And then they're throwing this, like, borderline tag onto her when, I don't know, it did not seem... Then again, borderline has many, many different symptoms, but watching that show, like, I could not relate. And then all of a sudden they said borderline, and I'm like, why?
Especially, like, borderline is something that really people know very little about.
Yeah.
Like, OCD is something people sort of know about, like, mm-hmm. or at least they're familiar with it. Depression, people know what that is. They may not have the correct ideas about it, but they kind of know what it is, right? But borderline people may not know what it is. So then when maybe the only thing they've ever heard about it is watching that show, it's like, oh, that's dangerous.
Yeah, forever. That's right.
So I have an album that's going to be coming out that I wrote. It's just me and my ukulele. My stage name is Less Than Three. It makes a heart less than three.
That's
what I thought you were going
And it's
that.
Also less than three because it's me and my ukulele. But the album is going to be called Borderline Tendencies. And it's all going to be songs about the way that I live with borderline and how it's kind of... I started saying this because I was talking with somebody and I mentioned how I was writing a bunch of songs and I was writing an album about borderline. And they're like, borderline personality disorder? Isn't that where you're like a liar and a manipulator and you like cheat on people?
Oof.
And it was just like, first of all, how can you just say that to someone? Like, it was super rude. And then I was like, that is exactly why I'm writing my album. Like, mm-hmm. part of it is to release the stigma. Like, you see the way that I act, but you don't, like, feel the way that I feel in the situations. Like, I've had to, like, sit with my boyfriend and... like, break down, like, he'll be like, okay, I don't understand why this just happened, and then I'll break it down, and then he'll be like, oh, okay, now I understand. Mm-hmm. It wasn't one thing, it was all of these things that built up, and then all of a sudden, it's like a cup, and I'm already, like, this full of water, and there's only this much more room. It doesn't matter if I fill it up with water, or orange juice, or vodka, it doesn't matter what fills it up, what emotion. All of a sudden, it's going to overflow.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a great analogy. Yeah,
I came up with it one time. And I was very proud of myself.
Yeah,
right?
No, that's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one more thing I wanted to discuss before we wrap it up is sort of what the stigma looks like in the church, because I feel like that's like one that's a little bit different. And in my experience, there's been a lot of people. Like, I remember telling my mom that I wanted to kill myself in the seventh grade. And she was like, she was like so upset, you know, like she felt, I'm sure she probably felt like, I must be a terrible mother, my daughter's a sad, or, you know, something like that. I mean, she was really, really upset, but like she just kept saying things like, why, what's going on? Are your friends mean? Are your, you know? And it was like, I couldn't pinpoint it on anything. It was just, I felt sad and I didn't know why. And it wasn't even necessarily as much sadness as it is, like, just almost nothing. You know, it's just like, I just don't want to live, like, I don't know. And there's so many times I've noticed people that, you know, with great intentions, they just don't understand it. Mm-hmm. You know, and you say you have depression, and they'll be like, but the joy of the Lord, mm-hmm. you know, you have the joy of the Lord. And it's like, okay, there's a difference between I just feel sad, or I don't cognitively understand something, and I have clinical depression, and my
the
brain
chemical imbalance that is legitimately
makes me feel down sometimes, yeah. or feel nothing sometimes, which can sometimes be worse than feeling sad. Mm-hmm. And people with the greatest intentions are just like, they want to cheer you up.
Right. They think so, it's circumstantial.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
something happened. What happened? How
and
can I make it better?
Sometimes it is circumstantial, and sometimes mm-hmm. if you can figure out the trigger, then the depression will start to come, you know, calm down. But a lot of times it's not. And it's not like you necessarily, one person has the power to just, like, talk you into not being depressed, you know. But people that just don't understand it, they say a lot of things like that. And it's interesting because there are some churches that believe, like, if you pray for God to, like, heal your cancer, then you're not healed, then you must not have enough faith or something.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not super common. Most people are like, okay, we'll pray for healing, but sometimes that's just not the plan, or, you know, whatever. And we don't, like, blame you for not being healed of your cancer, right? But for whatever reason, I sort of feel like a lot of people have that idea about mental illness. That's like, if you don't spend enough time with God so that he could heal you of your depression, then you must not have enough faith.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, like, people don't exactly treat mental illness the same way they treat physical illness.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I don't know if you had anything to say about that.
Well, I've, in my personal experience, I mean, I have a few instances that I can try and recall. But one thing that I've noticed is that, you know, they kind of have the ignorance about it. You know, maybe they don't know about it. They do have good intentions. They're like, oh, you know, feel better. You know, I'm praying for you. And I hope that, you know, you're doing the same thing. But they hide behind that ignorance. And they don't do anything to actually learn about what's going on. That way they
right.
can actually help you. Instead of just the handshake and the hug and stuff like that. And that, I mean, that kind of aspect, at least in the church, in my experience, has applied to a lot of different areas.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the biggest one, because this is what gets swept under the rug.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if you guys heard in the news, because if I don't know if this is something that would be in your circle, but there was a pastor that was a pastor of a mega church who had killed himself because
mm-hmm.
he was depressed and his wife had no idea. And
people,
you know,
don't realize mental illness can be terminal.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you think cancer, oh, you're dying. It's like, if someone has serious depression,
mm-hmm.
you know, I watched a video on suicide awareness last week for my master's program, and they were talking about, they said, people don't die of suicide, they die of depression.
Right.
They die of the pain
yeah.
that they can't
live anymore. It does not get
anymore.
Better.
And so I don't know that people take it seriously enough in that way.
Yeah, which is why I was saying, you know, a lot of it is ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
But when, in my circumstance, like when I had attempted suicide, I was living with friends at that time. They didn't notice anything. And, you know, part of the thing was, you know, they didn't reach out or anything like that. And what had happened was, you know, I'd attempted suicide. A lot of events had happened in my life. I ended up moving back with my parents. And, you know, I had realized what were my triggers and what were things in my past that were keeping me depressed and keeping me in this box that just kept me suffocating, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you and I got engaged, a lot of the adults that were like my mentors and stuff like that were great, they came to the engagement party. And the following Sunday we went, because I wanted to thank everyone, we went back to the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw who I would have considered my friends maybe 2 or 3 years prior, none of them walk up to me, none of them say hey. I think only one of them even looked me in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they knew about my suicide attempt, because I certainly didn't tell them, and I didn't tell anyone that would have told them.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was one person that came up to me who I'm not going to say his name, but essentially he, after years of not having contact, his first thing to me was he was trying to, I guess, resolve a qualm that he had with me, something that he was dealing with himself, that he was angry about, and
it was something sort of minor.
It was very minor. And, you know, I told him that, you know, I mean, you're upset, but dude, we haven't talked in 3 years. And I'm like, I bet you that you don't even know that I tried to kill myself, because nobody in this room, and I was in the sanctuary, so this room was a very big encompassing term.
Yeah, no one like, followed up.
Nobody said, nobody tried to talk to me. You know, no one included me in anything. Mm-hmm. And isolation is the killer for any mental illness, mm-hmm. no matter what it is. Mm-hmm. So, and when I said that, there was a slight pause and deer in the headlight look on his face, but then he continued on with what he was saying because he didn't know how to respond, or yeah, maybe so he was in denial about it. Yeah. And that's when that showed me that, you know, he was in leadership. I don't know if he still is. I'm sure he is. But he didn't know how to handle that. He didn't know how to address it. You know, he didn't say anything. He didn't even say, man, I'm sorry to hear that, or anything. Yeah. And it broke my heart, because that was the day that I realized, all right, I gotta cut ties.
Yeah.
This is it.
And that's sort of why I'm doing this podcast, is to just sort of, I think if people sit down and they listen to this, maybe they will understand better, like, somebody that has an OCD tendency, right? And not think about what they maybe had originally thought it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or now, if they see someone mention borderline in a television show, they're like, okay, that's not always what it looks like, you know? And so I'm hoping that if people can hear it from just people's life experience, then they can realize that these stereotypes about mental illness are not necessarily true or common, you know? So anyway, to wrap it up, I usually do this card game. It's like questions about empathy, and so everybody just pick one. There's a few that are instruction cards mixed in there, so if you get an instruction card, you can have it back.
We're just doing one?
You should just have a question. Yeah, just one.
That's no fun.
Oh, this one's
I don't like this card. One.
I don't like this one.
You can try it.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I'm picking up a few. These are all like instructions. Hang on. Ooh, okay. I guess we can work with that one.
Who wants to go first?
Okay, I guess we'll continue the counterclockwise method here. All right. It says, when negative emotions arise, how do you deal with them? All right, so
that's a great question for this.
Yeah, that's why I'm like, oh, yep, this is it. Okay, so I'm a storyteller, so forgive me, I have a couple stories to tell to go along with this. So, as I said before, you know, I'm a music director. On the side, I do a couple other things. I'm a creative director for my company, and I also substitute for Volusia County Schools. And in the classes, you know, they're kids. I'm substituting for seniors. They're also ignorant, and, you know, we were all there at some point. And, you know, I hear there's this just one loud girl in one of the classes, and she's sitting there. Man, you're so bipolar. Like, one day you're happy, the next day you're not. Mm-hmm. And I can't say anything to her necessarily, because, you know, I'm supposed to be the teacher. And the fact that people think that bipolar is just simply being moody, to where one day, like, you're happy, the next day you're sad, it's not. For those who don't know, you go through stages of manic, which is extreme highs. Mm-hmm. That manifests maybe by spending a lot of money, maybe eating a lot of food, just doing a lot of stupid stuff because your adrenaline is just spiked and you feel good. You're on a high. And that'll last for a while. For people, it lasts weeks to months. Mm-hmm. And then comes the depression part, which is why it's bipolar, because you have the two ends, to where you then depressed for weeks to months, to where it manifests different for everyone, obviously. Mm-hmm. But for me, you know, just there was no point in doing everything. Everything lost its color. There was no point in me doing music. Just a lot of dreary, which, you know, everyone gets that effect from watching sad music videos. But with me not being on medication, I do still experience these from time to time. But one thing that I've learned to do is I know my triggers, my personal triggers, and I do my best to avoid them. And if I'm unable to avoid them, then I immediately try and find essentially my happy space. I'm an introvert, so for me, being in a group of, like, this is fine. Like, this is great. This is essentially one-on-one to me. But anything, like, over, like, five or six people, like, that's draining to me, and that's stressful. So for me, being alone, just writing out my thoughts, you know, not with the intention of turning it to music, even though sometimes that happens, obviously, but, you know, lightening my heart through the ink that's on my paper. Mm-hmm. And most of the time I tear it up or I burn it. That way I never have to deal with it again, because that's not meant to be permanent. Everything's temporary in regards to that.
Yeah.
So I'll do that, or I'll try and be around those who I know are encouraging me on an emotional level, whether they are say something or not. Because there are those that drain you, and there are those that supply love and affection to you, whether just sitting in the room. Mm-hmm. And as the years have gone on, my circle has shrunk. I never really had a big circle anyway, mm-hmm. but as time goes on, you know, adulthood, and, you know, with the stuff going on that you find out with your mental illness, you see those who stick around, you see those who leave you.
Yeah.
And the ones that stay, even if they don't 100% understand, they obviously show that they're trying. And that's a huge thing right there, is effort. But that's how I do it, is I get my thoughts out. Typically, I burn it, because I give it its 5 seconds of power, is what I call it. I will literally count to five, and I'm like, all right, you had your reign, now it's over. And then being around those who encourage. So.
Yeah. How about you?
Okay, well, full disclosure, I picked like 4 different cards, and I picked the question that I wanted to answer.
Maybe we should do one more after this. I like this.
And my card, the question is, where do you feel most present? And my answer is probably last thing at night when I'm in bed, and everything in my head that I have had to check or do is like fulfilled, and I can relax, mm-hmm. and just, I don't have anything impending that I need to check off my list or worry about. So I can actually have a clear mind and literally be present and be, you know, go over my day and what happened and think about the day that I've had.
Mm-hmm.
So that is where I feel most present.
All right. How about you?
I got, what does approaching a breakthrough feel like?
Hmm.
Mm. I'm going to start this off with, I mentioned before how I have tried like almost every medication under the sun.
Mm.
And the only thing that started helping me was DBT, which is dialectical behavioral therapy, which is like rewiring your mind type of thing, where you focus on, the big thing that they say is watch and notice and then wait to react.
Interesting.
And I've been getting really upset at my cat lately. I love him. He is so cuddly. He's great. But for some reason, he likes to pee on things. And I kept getting so mad at him. And then I'm like, well, I can't yell at him because he's a cat. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what to do about it. And I kept getting so upset. And so one day I was like, you know what I'm going to do? Instead of getting upset, I'm just going to write a song. And I wrote a song about how my cat is a jerk and pees on things, but I love him. And I feel like...
I hope that made the EP. Please
do. It did. It's called Ode to Oliver. My cat's name is Oliver.
You just made my day.
But I feel like that... I went to my... I have a group that I go to, and I was telling my social worker about it. And to watch her face change because she saw me from where I used to be, and to be like, wow, you're really doing it. Like, awesome. You don't need medication. You're really getting it. And it felt, I'm sorry. It felt really good. It was, yeah, I don't know. I can't describe feelings because I have so many. So yeah.
Nice.
I'm not going to cry, I promise.
It's okay.
Feel free to.
All right, so our last one is, how has your past shaped who you are?
Oof.
Yeah. I feel like people have told me for a long time, like, you live in the past. You're like, But just my personality type, like, I like to understand things. Like, Tate and I were talking about music before we started this, and I was like, yeah, it's like, I teach music from, like, this logical standpoint. You know, like, my day job is teaching math. I like to understand things, and in fact, you know, my master's program, I've been getting sort of frustrated by, like, so many things are gray with, like, therapy, because, like, oh, well, it just depends on the way you see it. Like, there's so many different opinions and, like, theories. And I'm like, if I can't wrap my brain around it, I get really frustrated. So I feel like that's how I've kind of treated my past, is like, how can I understand it and then use that to make me better now? And so it becomes very hard for me to deal with things that I can't explain. Like, sometimes things just happen, you know? But I do try to find a way to, like, take that and then make something out of it. So then it's like, it's not like it didn't matter, you know? And so that's sort of like how I ended up with this podcast, is like, I want to make a difference. I was in two really bad car accidents, and I actually have a tattoo. It says Carpe Diem. And it's a miracle that I'm alive. Like, my car flipped 3 times, landed upside down, no airbags deployed, no glass broke. My sister and I both crawled out of the car without a scratch on our bodies. And this was the second accident. And I don't know why I'm alive. And I asked myself for many weeks, I was just like, why? Like, why am I here? I sang at a funeral for a girl, actually at the church that we go to now, as like a guest. They, someone asked for someone who could sing the song or whatever, and they're like, we'll pay you, and da da da. And I was like, I don't want the money. It's like, this 30-year-old girl died in a car accident. I was like, I'll be there. And I sang the song her mother requested, and I was just like, watching this whole funeral, I was like, why did she die and I don't? And, you know, survivor's guilt is learning in my therapy programs. I'm like, yep, that sounds right. But for me, that just like fueled this fire of like, I'm living on borrowed time. This is a day I wouldn't have had. This is an hour I wouldn't have had. And like, I don't want to waste it, because I don't know when my number gets called, you know? And I know it could have been years ago, you know? And so I try to make sure that every minute it's like something I'm going to be proud of. And then like when that time comes, I'll know that I didn't waste it, you know? So that's like one of the biggest things that sort of changed my life as far as the past, and like changing my future. Anyway, thank you all so much for coming. I feel like this is really one of the best episodes so far. And I knew there was like a lot of things that we could talk about here. So I really appreciate everybody. And for all the listeners, thank you for tuning in either on YouTube or on iTunes. And if you're listening to this, you know, on YouTube, if you don't mind trying to find some of our other outlets and subscribing, if you subscribe to iTunes, it'll let you know and you can listen to it in the car. And then we're also on SoundCloud and basically anywhere else you can find podcasts.
If you like, have an us Android, on Facebook and Instagram.
Facebook and Instagram. If you have an Android, we're on the Google Play Music Store. So anywhere where you find your podcasts, we should be there. And if you have any questions for me, you can email me at joy@empathyglobal.org.
Au revoir.